Part 23, Chapter 4. Johnny watched Stormalong's old orbit miner come in. A sentry turned off the atmosphere armor shield and let the plane through, and they turned it back on. There was always a faint sizzle from it when the power went on, but after that it was silent. Aside from some luckless birds and insects that hit it and sometimes left a feather or feelers, one wouldn't know it was there. All pilots had had to be warned, and a complex set of guard signals had had to be developed lest some pilot crash his ship. Stormalong put the old ship alongside a metal pulverizer. The Cyclos used a device which first softened metal by breaking down its molecular cohesion and then let it go through armored rollers that really tore it apart and smashed it. The result was a metal powder so fine that if one threw a handful into the air, a lot of it stayed there, like fine dust. The Cyclos needed it that way for part of their fuel and ammunition processes. Using the ship's own cranes, the co-pilot began unloading the catch into the metal pulverizer. Stormalong got out and came over.
55 tons this trip,
he said smugly.
There's plenty up there, trapped in orbit. Think we'll need any more?
Johnny wasn't sure. He had been on to other things. They walked down into the compound to verify. One of the Buddhist communicators came up. They had a way of moving which always intrigued Johnny. They would put their right hand into their left sleeve and their left hand into their right sleeve, and then they would move their feet in a sort of fast trot shuffle. Their shoulders didn't bob. The result made them look like they were floating or scooting. Until yesterday, many had continued to wear their reddish-yellow robes. These and their shaven heads made them too easy to single out from above. A huge batch of packages and uniforms had come in from Ivan. People there had been reworking cloth sent to them from some looms now operating in Luxembourg. They were green uniforms with an armored aluminum helmet, also green. Johnny supposed that all their forces would be in these soon. The Buddhist was wearing his now. He bowed, always a bow, and handed Johnny a package. He was so very sorry. There was so much in, distribution was delayed. Johnny bowed back. It was contagious. He and Stormalong walked on through the compound looking for Angus. Johnny was opening his package. It was from Ivan. A helmet, plain green, like everyone else's. Ear pads put on that would lift. There was a letter, some coordinator had written it for Ivan, on top of the helmet.
Dear Marshal Johnny, your village people arrived and are very happy, and so are we. Dr. Allen got the old man Jimson off some weed he was eating, and he looks like he will live. Your people all say, how do you do? Hello. Tom Smiley also says, how do you do? Hello. Your horses got shipped over here, and they are now learning to speak Russian. Joke. But they are fine. I worked on Blodgett, and she can run pretty good now. You must always look after horses. We got the Buddhist library down deep now, and it's safe. On the helmet, I wish I could tell you I had an angel visit me the night before you left. They told me you had to wear it. Your letter thanking me is received with embarrassment. I was not trying to save your life, but I would any time anyway. So I can't accept your gratitude. It was no angel. I just knew that in those high mountains you can freeze your...
scratched out.
Ears off. This helmet is less conspicuous. I didn't even put a star on it. Give my best to Chrissy when you ride. I hope somebody's looking after your clothes. Your comrade, Ivan, Colonel commanding Russian base until you can dig up some Americans.
It was a nice helmet, and it fit. There were a couple of small creases on it they hadn't quite rubbed out. Ivan must have fired some shots at it to make sure it would stop bullets. There was also a package of ammunition for the AK-47s. Johnny had advised them to bore a hole in the ends and put some thermite explosive powder in them, so they would be useful against Tolneps. They said it worked, and they were converting. Stormalong and Johnny had arrived at the meteorite powder washing area. Four Cyclo females were working hard, sloshing pans of metal powder around in huge tubs of mercury. They were gloved and clothed to protect them from mercury poisoning. When Stormalong had begun this orbit mining, it had been with an eye to training pilots and, Johnny suspected, to gratify a craving for wild flying. The stuff collected was odd enough. Meteorites and such got caught in orbit or perihelion, and before they sizzled down through the atmosphere, they were often crystalline and quite amazing. Johnny was about to put a stop to it. It had served its purpose, scaring the visitors half to death with limpet mines. But Angus, always prowling into something, had noted some pieces in a recent batch that were of different chemical structure. An outer space comet, not native to the system, had been blasting across the skies for some time. Angus pointed out to Johnny that it contained the tiniest traces of the unknown element Turl had used for the center of his device. Angus had shown him on the analyzer. There they were, microscopic traces of it. If the material had burned down through the atmosphere like meteorites usually do, the element might have vanished from the heat. But these virgin bits did contain it. Johnny had gone in circles for a day on how to extract it, and then remembered you could pan gold because it was heavier than dirt and rock. The Cyclos used literally tons of mercury in some mining process, so they got pans of it and tested it. Iron, copper, nickel, most elements now in powder form, were lighter than mercury and floated off or combined. But this strange element went to the bottom with a thud. It was terribly cohesive and clung to itself. It took an awful lot of powdered metal to get any. They could have rigged some machines to do the panning, but these Cyclo females couldn't care less about a big pan of mercury, and they happily sloshed it about, panning the powder. They smiled at Johnny. They were all right, unless somebody foolishly mentioned mathematics. You would lose one Cyclo female right then. It had happened with Chirk, and again with another one. They said Angus would be back, and they waited for him. He reappeared presently, and they asked him, did he need any more? Angus shook his head and beckoned. In the shop where he was working, Angus had duplicated Turl's box, with one exception. It didn't push all the elements together when you raised the lid. A timed piston did that. You set the time, and then the piston closed the rods. Angus had six of them. The center bit was probably not as pure a metal as Turl's, but they were sure that was of no importance. The weights were varied a bit, but all around 75 pounds for the center bit. Angus had not put the centers in place. He had those sitting well apart, and every one was making a dent in what it sat on.
Unless you've got in mind to blow up the universe, said Angus. Don't you think about eight will do? The load you just brought in should give us two more.
But what does it do?
Begged Stormalong. Johnny shook his head.
We don't know. But if Turl made one with that expression on his face, you can be very sure it is the deadliest weapon the Cyclos have. One thing you be sure of, Angus. Pack the core separately, and don't let anybody combine them on this planet. When you're all done, send them down to the underground armory in Kariba.
Johnny went out. He was feeling fairly cheerful. Lots of good things were happening. The Chinese in Kariba said they had engineers, and they did. But they were engineers expert in wood and stone and bridges and things. They also had some painters, and that small bowl and its surrounds looked pretty strange, but artistic. They lined internal bunkers with tile they made. It was all very neat. They even had a little village of their own between the atmosphere armor cable and the shore of the lake made by the dam. Their anti-aircraft pits had little pagoda rain domes over them. Good progress was being made in America. He was almost cheerful. They might have a chance. Thin, but possible. Of course, there was the mathematics thing. Lately, all Turl seemed to do was scan pages and pages and pages of incomprehensible mathematical equations. He had not started building a console, but he was obviously figuring it out from scratch. The old one was burned out. He had demanded it anyway for its case, and they had brought him all kinds of scrap, but none was it. It couldn't be, for Johnny had the original console, a burned to a crisp wreck, down in the garage here. So Turl would even have to do the metal case. Johnny saw a couple of Huckners being taken to another room. These prisoners fought each other, race to race, like wildcats. The tallest Huckner, not too bad-looking in spite of having no nose, was a lower-grade officer, but educated. He was showing vast interest in the vehicles parked around. Johnny stopped the group, intending to ask some questions. The tall Huckner was grinning superciliously at the vehicles. Ordinary Huckner crewmen didn't speak Cyclo, but their officers did. He recognized Johnny.
"You know,"
said the tall one,
"that none of these vehicle frames are built on Cyclo, don't you?"
"I didn't know,"
said Johnny. Although it made the sentries wary, the Huckner went over to a ground car and looked around under the edge of one of the bumpers.
"There,"
he said, pointing. Johnny looked at it. It was one of the alphabets on the galactic banknotes.
"That's Duralib,"
said the Huckner.
"It says, made in Duralib. The Cyclos import all their plane bodies and tank bodies and machinery from other systems and peoples. The Cyclos only furnish metals and then motors and consoles. Nobody can use this stuff except Cyclos, since nobody has the drives. These other planets build other things for other peoples. But this Cyclo stuff is useless if you don't have the consoles. They make those on Cyclo and only on Cyclo."
Johnny thanked him. He said,
"Don't thank me, old fellow. If you ever start running out of consoles and motors, while you can buy all the bodies you want, you won't have a thing. It's the way the confounded Cyclos run things. They've got a throat-choke monopoly on every universe. You can't go up against them. Huckners have tried. You'll just lose."
Johnny knew these prisoners, while cooperative, tended to be malicious. But he had heard this too often for it to be just a guess. He changed the subject.
"Did you fellows ever capture any cyclo-mathematics texts?"
The Huckner gave a laugh. It sounded like a horse neighing.
"Oh, my dear fellow, every wizard brain in the universe for 302,000 years has tried to figure out cyclo-mathematics. It can't be done. Oh, it isn't their arithmetic. An 11-numeral system is not too strange. There's a race that had 23 different numerals. It's their silly equations. Nothing ever balances. Texts. Anybody can pick up their texts. They're meaningless. Pure rubbish. Balderdash. Rot. Now, will you order them to give me and my crew something to eat? Like you did the Tulnip?"
Johnny told them to see McKendrick. He went to his viewing room and looked at Turl's vast numbers of worksheets again. He wasn't feeling so good now. Johnny had a bomb to land on Cyclo if necessary. Great! He didn't have a thing to land it there with. He had a rapidly growing force of visitors overhead. Turl was dawdling. Johnny had a very desperate plan to seize the console before it could be destroyed. But even if he got it, it might work just once and quit, if the Tulnip was right. He looked over Turl's equations again. They didn't balance. They didn't proceed one to the next, logically. Yet the whole fate of this planet depended, in the final analysis, on solving them. Maybe other people of other races had met this impasse, this same problem before, and lost. Maybe another being had sat here, like this, staring at texts and worksheets of cyclomath, uneasy, and with a feeling of hopelessness, and then gone out to be destroyed by the cyclos. His personal courage, meaningless.